A written transcript of this episode is provided by Starburst. For more information, you can see the show notes.
Welcome to Data Mesh Radio with your host, Scott Hurlman, sponsored by Starburst. This is Adrian Estala, VP of Data Mesh Consulting Services at Starburst and host of Data Mesh TV. Starburst is the leading sponsor for Trino, the open source project, and Jamak's Data Mesh book, delivering data-driven value at scale. To claim your free book, head over to starburst.io.
Data Mesh Radio, a part of the Data as a Product podcast network, is a free community resource provided by DataStax. Data Mesh Radio is produced and hosted by Scott Hurlman, the co-founder of the Data Mesh Learning Community. This podcast is designed to help you get up to speed on a number of data mesh-related topics. Hopefully, you find it useful. Bottom line up front, what are you going to hear about and learn about in this episode? I interviewed Dave Coles, the Director of Data and AI at ThoughtWorks Australia. I'd invited Dave on due to a few pieces of content, including a webinar on fitness functions he had done with Jamak in 2021. Key takeaways and thoughts and maybe some remaining questions that I have after this conversation. Number one, fitness functions are a very useful tool to assess questions of progress slash success at a granular and easy to answer scale level. Those answers can then be summed up into a greater big picture. You should start with fitness functions early in your data mesh journey so you can measure your progress along the way. To develop your fitness functions, ask, what does good look like? Number two, focus your fitness functions on measuring things that you will act on or are important to measuring success. Something like the amount of data processed is probably a vanity metric. Drive towards value-based measurements instead. Number three, your fitness functions may lose relevance, and that is okay. You should be measuring how well you are doing overall, not locking on to measuring the same thing every X time period. What helps you assess your success? Again, measure the things you will act on. Otherwise, it's just metrics. Number four, Dave believes the reason to create or the genesis of a mesh data product should be a specific use case. The data product can evolve to serve multiple consumers, but to start, you should not create data products unless you know how it will, or maybe likely will, be consumed and have at least one consumer lined up. Number five, team topologies can be an effective approach to implementing data mesh. Using the team topologies approach, the enablement team should focus on simultaneously, one, speeding the time to value of the specific stream-aligned teams they are collaborating with, and two, look for reusable patterns and implementation details to add to the platform to make future data product creation and management easier. That's a little bit confusing about the team topology specific terminology. Just listen to the episode or search around for some team topologies information. Number six, we still don't have a great approach to evolving our data products to keep our analytical plane in sync with the kind of quote unquote the changing reality of the actual domain on the operating plane. On the one hand, we want to maintain a picture of reality, what's actually going on. On the other, data product evolution can cause issues for data consumers. So we must balance that reflecting a fast-changing reality with data consumer disruption, including downstream and cross-data product interoperability. You know, if all of a sudden the way that you're reflecting the information of the domain changes, is that going to break your interoperability as well? There aren't great patterns for how to do any of this just yet. It's it's a challenge that we need to as a community come together and really share some information and figure out. And lastly, number seven, there is a trade-off to consider regarding mesh data product size. The smaller the data product, the less scope it has, which makes it easier to develop and maintain. But smaller scope data products will increase the total number of data products, likely leading to potentially harder data discovery. And do we have data product owners with many data products in their portfolios? Again, I think this is a question that we as a community really need to share information on, and there probably isn't a specific answer, but it's something to be aware of. With that bottom line up front done, let's jump into the interview. Very, very excited for today's episode. I've got Dave Coles here, who is the Director of Data and AI for ThoughtWorks Australia. And yes, this is the third or fourth person that's the Director of Data and AI at one of the ThoughtWorks things on the podcast. So I reached out to Dave specifically because he had done a webinar way back when, I want to say like August or so of last year, with Jamak about fitness functions. And fitness functions is a really interesting concept that I'm not that familiar with. So I'll let him kind of give the introduction, but it is a good way of measuring kind of your progress. How well are you doing? And is that the progress for your implementation? Is it the progress or the value that you're adding from a single data product? All of these things. I think it's a good way to think about approaching those questions and having a, instead of a qualitative, you have a bit more of a quantitative type approach. You're still going to have a qualitative answer, but that you've got a little bit more rigor in how you do that. And then a whole lot of other conversational topics about data mesh and kind of data and related topics. So very excited to kind of jump into that. Dave, if you don't mind, could you give people a little bit of a background to yourself, and then we can kind of jump into the conversation at hand.
Hi, Scott, and thank you for having me on today. My current role is similar to some of your other guests, Director of Data and AI at one of our ThoughtWorks countries. I've been at ThoughtWorks about 11 years now, in various roles as well across technical and organizational change. And prior to ThoughtWorks, my background was robotics engineering and CAD and simulation software in small R&D teams. So I guess I came from a perspective of making complex decisions easy for users and finding new ways to measure things. And so that's that was one of the lenses I brought to talking about fitness functions for data mesh. Because the reason I suggested to Jamak we give this talk was to sort of shift the conversation around data mesh away from what do we need to build and towards what does good look like and how do we know we're improving towards that and what do we need to measure in order to have to be able to answer those questions. And I think that in the world of centralized data, one of the challenges is that often we were working with vanity measures, e.g. what volume of data is on the platform, rather than actually connecting that value through to value delivered to consumers, though it might be described as a data asset in that case. You might also argue that it's simply data inventory. It's data waiting around to be transformed into a useful product. And, you know, from multiple perspectives, we seek to reduce inventory because we know that it represents a form of waste from a lean and even from an accounting perspective as well. So talking about how we might measure data mesh differently was great to create space for a different type of conversation.
I think it transitions well into good conversations with other people as well of that there is, because exactly what you said, so many people are like, how do I do this? How do I do this? Okay, give me the roadmap versus, hey, we're going to give you the kind of some things that you should really think about and what are some questions you should be asking and answering. And we're going to give you a framework for measuring that, but that it can pull them out of that. You need to tell me exactly what to do, because the whole point of data mesh is, well, you know, initially, even if you look at Jamak's early talks, not you know, people always refer to the Martin Fowler site posts. And I'm like, you should watch some of the early talks, because it's all stalking horse, right? It's all, hey, I think this could work. Let's talk about it. And it's evolved. And we need to have those conversations about, we need to have flexible approaches, and that we need to make it so that it is adaptable for people's organizations, but we can't pre-adapt it. We can't say, and here, you know, it's like, what are all the possible permutations of a 100, you know, 1,000 word book? Like, the math just doesn't exist, right? You can't think of that. I mean, maybe that is a potential math, but it's just not the way that the world works. It's not feasible. It's not reasonable. So I love that approach and that conversational thinking.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, even if, you know, the thought experiment that we had a perfect data mesh for an organization at a point in time, we know that wouldn't be static and that it would need to continue to evolve. And of course, every organization is a bit different in terms of its market, in terms of its technology estate, in terms of the capabilities and strategic direction. So there's certainly no one size fits all, and there's no static answer to what is data mesh. And I think that's exactly so, you know, the fitness function was introduced in software architecture in the book Building Evolutionary Architectures by Neil Ford, Rebecca Parsons, and Patrick Qua. And the concept, you know, it's a concept that's existed in sort of mathematical optimization for a while. So in that context, it's a function that tells you how good a solution is. And so this can be used to drive a whole range of optimization techniques like evolutionary algorithms. And so, you know, that's quite a formalized version. But in software architecture, you know, we try to strike the balance between creating a shared understanding as a focus for a conversation and alignment across an organization, and that quantitative side of can we measure and can we track how we're improving.
And you talked about kind of the vanity metrics versus, like, let's have a conversation about value, right? Like, that's why are we doing this, right? The number of times that I have conversations with people where they're saying, you know, not on the podcast, but when people are like coming to me and asking me questions, it's so much of, well, but why are you trying to do it? That, like, what is that going to achieve? Right. I saw somebody who I think it was Forbes. And I think that Forbes did a poor job of summarizing their article, but they said, it's never too early to build for scale. I'm like, yes, it is. Why would you do that? Why? Yes, you want to build so you can change for scale. But if you prematurely optimize, you're spending so much time and opportunity cost and all of that. So, you gave a little bit of an intro to a fitness function, but let's drill down into a little bit of, like, can you give a specific example or 'cause it, like, even on the webinar, it was still a little bit of kind of this vague thing to me of what exactly a fitness function might be. So, like, can you give a little bit more of a really concrete example to help people, or maybe two or three concrete examples to help people really understand what we're trying to, you know, are we trying to say, We're measuring it on this one SLA or SLO? Are we trying to, like, what is it?
great question. And, you know, it will vary a bit context by context. And again, the conversation, as you know, talked about, that why are we doing this? You know, it might be divergent. We might look at a whole range of different reasons why we might be doing something. And the discussion around fitness functions and then how we might measure that we were being successful can help us bring in, converge on a shared understanding of that. You know, oh, I thought we were going to measure it this way. No, this is how we measure it, and this is how we know what good looks like. But in terms of a concrete example, so data products have, a number of characteristics. They're supposed to be self-describable, addressable, and discoverable, and so on. And so what we might do is in the life cycle of a data product, through the build phase, we might have tests at various levels in the build and deployment pipeline that assert that the characteristics of a data product are met. And then we might continue to monitor that those characteristics of a data product are met in production in the run phase of the life cycle. And so that, that could be as simple as a health check that, we're able to discover some self-describing information about the data product at its address when it's running. And so that would be a really concrete example of a fitness function. And that would be a true false for one data product. But then as you start to roll that up across the mesh, then you might get a more granular view. And the satisfaction of SLOs. So there would be, satisfaction of those fundamental data product characteristics, but then product by product, each product would define its own SLOs around latency, quality, completeness, and so on. And so another fitness function might be, are the data products meeting their own defined SLOs? So again, this could be binary at a single product, but you could roll it up across the whole mesh to get a picture of how well the mesh is performing in that regard.
And do you typically find that fitness functions are better with binary answers of yes, no, or is it that you because when you have that, what is our latency? Okay, our P99 is 40 milliseconds. Okay, is that good?
Yes, and this is where the conversation becomes important, and you might actually have a range of measures as well that help you triangulate on what's good, because it's always possible to game a single measure, and that's the last thing we want, that a fitness function or a measure that's guiding our direction becomes a target to aim for instead. You might certainly, when it comes down to a kind of adapting or extending a unit testing approach into fitness functions, it helps to have something that passes or fails. But when you start talking about P99, that might be a statistical assessment or a assessment across aggregated data, whether it meets or fails some criterion. You can also consider, continuous fitness functions as well. When you start to have a whole lot of binary decisions, for instance, at individual product level, you start to get a measure across the whole mesh about proportion of compliance, for instance.
If I'm trying to measure, are we doing well or things like that, that can be a very qualitative thing. Is it that you recommend that people have kind of those roll-up metrics that are quantitative and that you have that? Like, if you were to walk into an organ, because to me it's like, okay, I guess I can just ask 8,000 questions and then I just get 8,000 answers, and do I still know if this is good or bad? Like, is it that you start to think about what should my benchmark be, or what, like, how do you go from the concept of a fitness function to actually measuring, are we doing well with our implementation? Are we doing well with our long-term vision? And are we doing well with where we are now? Because no, we're not at all at our long-term vision. We might be at 10% coverage of our long-term vision, number of domains that have rolled out a quality data product, and we're at 10%. That could be good. You could be in month, 3, 4, 5, and you're like, that's a really, really good, level of progress. But how do you take that the concept and actually go into an organization and go, we're going to start doing these, and we're going to, instead of just kind of having qualitative random things, we're going to start to actually quantify and say, are we doing what we think we need to be doing?
Yeah. Look, great question. I think the examples I gave were quite bottom up, roll up, but I think you definitely also start from the top down perspective, discussing what you're trying to achieve. And so in that regard, you know, data mesh needs to plug into the organizational strategy primarily, and we need to be able to demonstrate a link from organizational strategy top down, decomposing the strategy into, and the technique we've used there is the lean value tree from the edge approach, and decomposing that down into a portfolio of bets that data products can support. But from a perspective of implementing a data mesh, and like the top down, we would look at each of the principles and around domain ownership. You know, what we want to be able to measure is, are we reducing the interdependence of domains? So in some way, can we pull out some metrics that show that domains are autonomous while remaining aligned to an overall vision? In the product space, the key question we're asking is, are we delivering value from data, not just accumulating inventory? In the platform space, what we're asking is, can we abstract complexity effectively? And, you know, can we see an impact on teams' ability to deliver and operate their data products as a result? And then I think in the governance space, which, you know, we were talking about before, is evolving, and we're trying to understand what good looks like. What we're trying to measure is the whole greater than the sum of the parts? Because from a domain and a product perspective, you know, we're trying to ensure that the parts remain independent to a degree and are delivering value in a way that's independent of each other. But the governance is, you know, when we put those together, do we have something that's greater than the sum of the parts as a result?
Yeah, I've kind of shelved it, but I might bring it back out of the SCAE, which is Scott's Confusing Ass Equation, which is like each data product itself, in and of itself, should have value. Jamak has said that, right? You don't just have ones that have no value in and of themselves, because then that really isn't, that has interdependence, right? If the value has to be dependent on something else. But when you start to think about the value of the overall data mesh, it isn't just the data products, because then you've got kind of value silos. If you have that greater whole, that greater thing of interoperability, and, you know, is that literally only the data interoperability, or is it the informational interoperability, so people can know what the connections are? And you may not even be able to interoperate the data products, but like, how do you start to think about where each data product, the value that it might bring, you know, at the beginning is one, and the interoperability is 0.1. But, you know, by the time you get to 50 data products, it's bringing an incremental value of one for each data product, and it's bringing an interoperability value of one. And then you get to 1,000 or whatever, and it's like the incremental value of the data product is one, and the interoperability is 10, right? And so, yep. Like, that's where, like, where is that tipping point? And you know, with Samia Raman, who was on, she talked about the ability to kind of iterate towards interoperability and things like that. And I think that could be an interesting aspect as well, to kind of measure how much interoperability do we have, or how well, you know, a couple of people have come on and they really, really hate net promoter score, but that can be another thing to at least get your arms around, like what's going on with data products or with domains or things like that, that I think it can give you a little bit of guidance toward this. But it sounds like what you're saying is kind of the same thing that when people have asked me, how do I get started with data mesh? It's like, let's get concrete. Let's drill down instead of let's try and answer this in all one fell swoop.
Yes. And you know, compartmentalize the complexity of data mesh in that regard. So, that we're Exactly those points that I ran through, that we're reducing interdependence, that we're delivering value, abstracting complexity, and delivering a whole that's greater than the sum of the parts.
It's kind of like data products when you think about them, right? Like, yes. they interoperate in to give you a bigger picture of yes. how you're doing.
Yeah, and I think ultimately from that product perspective, it comes down to consumption. You know, are we are consumers, as a proxy for value, are consumers, are we seeing consumption of the data products in the mesh, and what patterns of consumption are we seeing? In terms of a fitness function, you know, what's good? Well, think about rates and ratios over time. So is it growing in this area that's aligned to the strategy of the business? Net Promoter Score has its promoters and its detractors. But it might be better to have like some sort of feedback signal than no signal at all. There's not necessarily, again, that the answer of which fitness functions to use is not a static answer either. So it depends a little bit. It depends a bit on, you know, how you can actually respond to these fitness functions as an organization and do things differently as a result, because if you're not actually connecting them through to action, then they're not necessarily helpful measures. We also think about sort of three stages of measures as well, and bringing a lot of thinking over from the practical test pyramid, recognizes that makes a case that there's a portfolio of tests at different levels of a system gives you the most economical way of getting feedback on its quality. So you might have a large number of cheap tests at the unit test level, which give you a very granular view, and you might have a small number of more expensive tests at a behavioral level, which give you an overall view. And of course, you can translate this into the monitoring space as well. And then sort of taking that thinking into data mesh, we might have a lot of granular tests around data quality and around the service of data products. Then we might have some tests around leading measures or leading metrics around, are we following good process? When we model our data, how well does the modeling process work? So this might be a measure of an ML model. It assumes, given some data, it produces some level of performance, but, that's hard to separate in reality from the data quality going into the model, but we can assess the performance of the model separately to that. And then we might also look at the business outcomes that follow, starting with good data, following good practice, and then as a result, we might look at the business outcomes as more lagging but outcome-oriented measures.
Yeah, and I think I want to say it was Katie Bauer who said, measure things that you're going to have a reaction to, that you're going to act upon. So like, here's our test coverage number. Okay, but what are we going to do with that? Like, it's good to know, but are we going to actually push that if we get a number that's not where we want it to be?
Yes. And so I think you can feel free to prune measures that aren't connected to action, or review whether you could get more out of closing that feedback loop.
And so one concept that I haven't covered a lot with, and we talked about in our pre-call, that I think is really useful, is kind of the wrapping in team topologies and the concept of the enabling team. Can you give people a little bit of background on it? Anytime I've tried to explain team topologies, I'm just like, it's just, you bring in people and they really help, and it makes it so that people can actually do their job, but like that they learn how to do the stuff that they're going to have to keep managing, but the one-off they don't have to do, and then blah. And it's just like, I just can't explain it at all. So like, I would love to hear about the concepts within team topologies and how you're seeing that be effective when you're looking at a data mesh implementation.
Yeah, I thanks. I think the Team topologies is a good framework for, I guess, the architecture of the organization and the communication patterns and responsibilities within teams and then between teams. I think it's quite complementary to the technical architecture of data mesh in that regard, you know, being a socio-technical approach, as it's described. You know, there is a technical architecture, but there's a team architecture or an operating model that goes along very closely with that. And so team topologies gives us a way to design those teams that are sympathetic to a data mesh architecture and very, mutually complementary and mutually beneficial. In some respects, following the principle of Conway's law that states that organizational system architecture is going to reflect the communication patterns in its teams. It's possible to do a so-called inverse Conway maneuver and design teams in the way that you would like to see the system architecture emerge. And so what team topologies does is, it's similar to data mesh. It introduces some sort of fundamental building blocks that can then be put together in more complex ways. So the basic unit of value delivery, like a data product, I guess, is a stream-aligned team in team topologies. So we would see an affinity between stream-aligned teams and data products. A stream-aligned team delivering a data product in a mature data mesh environment, but there are obviously going to be a number of transitional phases along the way. And so a stream-aligned team has some end-to-end capability and responsibility for delivering some sort of value stream within the organization. And so they're the sort of primary unit of value delivery like data products are, but they need to be supported by a wider team architecture as well. And so, in a mature environment, the way that can happen is through a platform team. And so a platform team would, again, have some affinity with the self-service data platform in a data mesh technical architecture. And that platform team would interact with the stream team in a mode that team topologies describes as a service. And so this might be through an automated API. A stream-aligned team can self-serve resources, data, computation, whatever it needs through the interface, the API interface, as defined by the platform team. And so this platform team then doesn't, there's no blocking of work that the stream-aligned team is doing, because the value of the stream-aligned team is that they have end-to-end control over their work and thus can work in very short cycles and incorporate feedback from their product delivery into the design of the product and implementation of the product. And the reason why that non-blocking is so important, a number of years ago, I was in one of my organizational transformation roles working on an agile transformation with a large telco in Australia. And we discovered that, it's not quite the level of rigor of the DORA team and the Accelerate metrics, but we discovered that work going outside of a team would typically take 12 times as long to complete as work that stayed within a team in that environment. And so the effect of relying on another team for delivery that you're supposed to own becomes quite a heavy cost for these stream-aligned teams. So you have stream-aligned teams supported by platform teams, so that they can deliver value. And then into the mix, you add the concept of an enabling team, because a stream-aligned team now has a lot of different concerns that it needs to cover over the evolution of the kind of organizational digital playbook. We've seen more and more concerns layered into stream-aligned teams, starting with product management and user experience design, DevOps, security, infra, potentially ML. And so you have these enormous portmanteaus of DevSec, infra, ML, ops, responsibilities for a team. And so into that world, the enabling team comes to help a stream-aligned team make the most of those individual capabilities and to provide a ramp onto consuming those capabilities. And so this can be sort of an streamlined, an enabling team might be more specialized to those functional capabilities and might work with a streamlined team for some time to bring them up to speed, but not on a permanent basis. And the idea is to embed that in the team. And then add to that, I guess, the notion of a complicated subsystem team, which is, you know, when one of these capabilities becomes too much to manage for any one team, put that into a complicated subsystem team.
It's funny because I don't know if you listened to the podcast episode of Pragmatism in Practice with Danilo and somebody, I can't remember his name, at the from ITV, talking about their data mesh implementation. And Scott Hawkins, when he was on, talked about that they are having these kind of consultant teams in a box. And we had a community discussion about who should be your data product developers, right? Should it be these enabling teams that drop in and help create the data products because they're experts in extracting the context and actually wrapping that into and making it something that can communicate the context of the domain externally in that, you know, embedded in that data product itself in the way that it's actually structured. But then are you kind of handing over maintenance of a tank to somebody who can kind of drive a stick shift car, maybe? You know, like, it's just this thing of, or do you give it to the software engineers who have no real concept in most cases of like how to actually do data right? Or do you have a data engineer, analytics engineer, that's the main interface, but then they become a single point of failure for that domain, or they can become a single point of failure. And so how are you seeing that kind of exactly what you talked about of this manifestation on data product creation, maybe? How are you seeing that actually manifest in the different data mesh implementations?
Yeah. That's, I mean, I think this is a really key question how to build the capability in a decentralized world, how to build those deep capabilities in a decentralized world. And I think the pattern that we've been seeing is, you know, I did talk about facilitation, and so this is one of the interaction patterns that team topologies define, facilitation in a functional speciality. But I think what we're seeing in the early days, at least, is more a different mode which team topologies defines, which is collaboration, which is a much more intensive way of working around shared outcomes and shared learning and development. And what we're seeing is a bit more of a multidisciplinary enablement team that collaborates with stream-aligned teams to help them understand, design and deliver their first data products. It's not a permanent relationship, but it's a collaboration relationship, which means two-way sharing and real ownership of the solution that's developed collaboratively, rather than, you know, as you say, handing over an alien artifact and expecting the team to be able to run with it. But the other benefit of that is that this enabling team actually understands the right abstractions for the stream-aligned teams. And so then this enabling team can bring that knowledge back to the platform team as well. And as a result, you know, yeah, you talked about it can be too early to scale. It can definitely be too early to scale if you bake the wrong abstractions into the platform. And then, you know, every product that comes after that is wrestling with an outdated view of the world. If we can use that enabling team to actually create a two-way flow of information and provide requirements, as it were, back to the platform team about how stream-aligned product teams want to interface with the self-service data platform, then that can be a really effective mode as we're in that initial scaling stage, scaling and designing at the same time.
I'm actually hearing from a couple of people that their goal or their plans are to throw out each of their first 10 data products within the first 6 months, because it's about finding those repeatability patterns, right? It's about finding like exactly what you talked about, that platform team. People think of platform as platform, and it's like, no, it's not just the tech. It's the everything. It's that abstraction team. And that's where it gets wrapped into the governance as well, that central governance team, their role is to make it so that, you know, 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 equals greater than 4, right? That the sum is greater than the whole. And so they have to be tied in with the actual ways of working, the flows, like where are we seeing things that we can reuse, and where are we putting it in front of the teams and going, don't reinvent the wheel if you don't need to. But if you're going overseas, the wheel isn't really going to be very helpful to you. So, you know, I mean, maybe a water wheel might be, but you know, so you might have to reinvent the wheel literally because you're not doing a wheel, you're doing a water wheel. So like, it's an interesting concept. How are you seeing people really evolve with their data mesh implementations? Are you seeing that when people are focusing on, because a lot of people, even when they do their proof of concept, they do a proof of concept around a data set, not around creating a data product, and definitely not around a data mesh. So like, how are you seeing the ones that are being successful? You know, and hopefully all your clients are successful, but there are probably going to be ones that want to move in directions that you don't love. But like, where are you seeing the things where people are gaining momentum and keeping their momentum going forward?
Yeah. I think the observation around potentially throwing away the first 10 data products is an interesting one, and kind of relates to optimizing for learning in the early stages of a data mesh delivery, and it also kind of forces us to sort of question what is it we're throwing away. Because when it comes to reuse, and evolution of the platform, we might get that at multiple levels, either starting off with ideas and patterns or sensible defaults, through to starter kits, template starter kits, even SDKs before we reach a sort of full self-service platform. So in terms of the platform development, you know, that's a pattern that we're seeing. You know, understand that you won't be able to build everything from the outset, but understand that reuse comes in and efficiency from learning comes in many different forms. And so, you know, be prepared to deliberately manage through that cycle of sensible defaults, accelerators, through to full services. In terms of products, very much being able to take an iterative and customer led product delivery approach as well. And so, that naturally leads beyond just delivering a data set to actually considering what data products add above a data set, which is that they're created to serve a specific use case, a user-driven goal. We bake SLOs into that product, and we care about ownership and governance on an ongoing basis.
It's funny because you wrapped in a couple of other things that were going to be my next question anyway, which is the concept of what is the genesis? What is the creating factor for a data product? When you and I were talking earlier, it's like, start with the business problem first. I've talked with a number of organizations that are trying to get to a sharing first culture, and they're not necessarily seeing a lot of consumption. You know, Bente Bush at NAV talked about, we're trying to train our data consumers that they actually want to consume data. You know, yes. In most organizations, data consumers are like, yeah, give me as much as I can. But like, there are a lot that are focused on, I'm going to share information that will then be, I'm going to share a data product that shares a bunch of data from my domain. And then I'm going to, and that's my source aligned. And then I'm going to kind of have within my own domain an aggregate, or it's a, like, it's not consumer aligned, but it's consumer driven, source aligned data product that is fed by these other ones where I've just got a repository of all the information. And a lot of times it's almost that that's, you know, just the mirror of the database. Which is just a terrible pattern, which we don't want to talk about. But like, how are you seeing that genesis, and how are you seeing the positives and the negatives of, you know, starting from the domain wanting to share their context in the way that they think about it, which was kind of what Jamak talked about a little bit in the early days as to how she thought it would might start and evolve, versus now what I'm hearing from everybody is start from an initial customer and focus on still being able to be reusable, but you have an initial like reason for this. You don't create a data product unless you have a frickin' reason where you have somebody who you've worked with and that you've set your SLOs with, and that you're like, there is a business value reason. So sorry, just threw a lot at you, but like, yes.
Yes. and I think there is a lot in there, and it is a tricky balance between creating a useful, a valuable representation of data at the source, which reflects the facts of the real world. I think the key value there is the alignment of the operational and the analytic worlds in that regard, so that, you know, we're not creating a whole lot of data quality and stitching problems downstream because our operational and analytic worlds have diverged at some point. But just building those truthful analytic representations of the world in a domain that's somewhat independent isn't going to deliver value to consumers alone. So it's the balance then is to have consumers pull some subset, and usually it's a thinner slice of the overall, the whole data that resides within that domain. Usually it's a thinner slice of that data that services a particular business problem. And so, you know, we can discover these opportunities with structured frameworks. You know, we can look at, you know, various ways that improved decisioning can reduce cost or improve revenue through better marketing, or improve customer experience, or unlock new revenue streams by connecting different markets together with data. And so, you know, that can be a starting point, but often those ideas already exist in the organizations we're working with. And so then it's a matter of why would a data product, at the extreme end, you could build a single data product to support one of these use cases. Why would a data product or a data mesh support this particular scenario, or this range of scenarios, this area of the business that's looking to improve through data-driven decisioning? And so when you have that opportunity, then you can trace that backwards through the data products that might support that. And often it's a fairly thin slice of the source data, which means that you reduce the effort to align the operational and the analytic space in that domain, reduce the scope rather, so that can again allow you to deliver value on a shorter cycle time through to the consumers, and ultimately you want to measure that consumption is happening, because that's the sort of key measure of success.
Yeah, there's about 15 questions that I've got as follow ups there, but so I'll give you two, and you decide which one you want to go to.
Choose your own adventure, or, as we call it in Australia. I think it's pick a path for you in the States.
Because we're coming up on time, so I want to give you enough time to answer whichever one you want to. So you talked about not letting the analytical and the operational diverge, right? We haven't figured out how to do that historically, right? The a lot of what scares a lot of people that have been around and focused on the enterprise data warehouse space is, well, you know, what happens if you don't get it right immediately? And it's like, and you have to evolve, and we have to figure out how we have that conversation, but also how we do it so that we aren't disruptive to the data consumers without care, right? We have to think about that. So that's one question, is how do we think about that? How do we do that? The other is you talked about the thin slice, and I'm going to ask you like kind of the Pandora's box question of data mesh, which is like how thin of a slice, right? You talked about like that. So the problem that I see with very, very small data products, right, in scope is that there's so dang many of them that your data discovery becomes incredibly difficult, because if you've got 2,000 data products on the mesh and you're looking at 45 of them that might be the thing that answers your question, that's obviously a horrible, horrible situation to try and dig through all of those, learn all the context, especially if you don't have a good UX plane, right? A good experience plane where all the data products kind of feel the same. You have to understand the new experience for each data product that you're trying to figure out. Is this the data product I want to use? So between those two questions of like, how thin of a slice do you want to do? And, you know, how do you want to balance that? You know, maybe there's a fitness function there, or yeah. How do we evolve our analytical side to continue to share what's going on with our, or, you know, our operational side? How do we actually learn how to do that? Because I haven't seen anybody talking about that. We've actually figured out how to do this at all. Graceful evolution.
Yeah. Look, two great choices. I might start with the second and come back quickly to the first if we have enough time. One of the answers I was going to give, as you highlighted, was around those fitness functions. So, you know, is it actually possible to consumer identify which data product might be relevant to a thin slice in a mature and an existing mesh? I think we proposed one of the fitness functions for a data product would be ease of discovery and ease of evaluation, and so you know that might be measured by how quickly can you determine whether a data product is going to suit your use case or not. So. That would be a measure of how well those products in the mesh are advertising their affordances for new use cases. But if you had to say create a new source data product to serve this use case, there's no simple answer to the unknown unknowns, but. The process of working in a multidisciplinary team that can go end to end from the consumer's needs through to understanding the source data that exists in the organization allows you to quickly iterate on what might be feasible and to narrow down on something that might be feasible. Working in a particular scenario. On a system that was quite an enormous monolithic system that handled a number of different interrelated business processes, we were able to narrow down fairly quickly in that mode to just a handful of tables that were relevant to a data product, and then target those for delivery through to the consumer in a very thin slice approach. To come back to the question around unifying operational and analytics, I think even the operational view of the world needs to handle errors and changing reality. So transactions are reversed and so on. I think this comes back maybe as well to understanding the consumer perspective, like how good does the analytic view of the world need to be? We worked with an organization in Australia that delivers geospatial data, national spatial data sets for a number of use cases. Everything from routing emergency services through to training self-driving cars. And so those consumers have very different needs for the accuracy of their data versus the freshness of their data. So, they're able to tolerate more data quality issues or inconsistencies if the data is fresher in some instances. in other instances, they want to make sure that, you know, that they've got the best representation of the world that, that we can produce with a lot of additional processing and time to resolve any inconsistencies. And so I think, like, it's not necessarily an entire solution, but I think it's one way to think about it, that by designing it as a product with consideration for the user's needs and what quality means in terms of fitness for purpose for their use case, allows us to square that circle to a degree.
Okay. Yeah. And I think, I mean, it's a super deep topic that we haven't, I'm just not seeing how we do graceful evolution of what we share on the analytics to match the operational. I just haven't seen anything on, like, how do we do that? How, you know, everyone's like, oh, versioning and all this. It's like, well, how do you do versioning? People are like, well, you have to do data APIs. How do you do data APIs? Well, they're APIs, right? Like we kind of have to go and dig into each of those topics to get to, like, how we actually do this. So.
Yeah. And it was a very surface level treatment, but I think the consumer perspective is really important. And answering, you know, what is quality and fit for purpose in my context.
Yeah, Emily Gorsensky kind of mentioned the same thing. When you're talking about your SLOs, have a conversation. Don't assume that they need, you know, 100% accuracy, which doesn't exist, and that they need it within milliseconds. And they said real time. Well, what they meant was they were sick of the 24 to 48 hour data warehouse cycle, but within 4 hours of it happening, totally fine.
And I feel like we've come full circle back to fitness functions again.
Yeah, exactly. This has been a great conversation. If people want to follow up with you, where do you want them doing that? You know, LinkedIn, is that the best place? And specifically, what would you like people following up with you about if you've got a specific kind of topic?
LinkedIn's a great place to find me, or through the ThoughtWorks website. You should be able to get in touch. I think, you know, these topics that we've discussed today around aligning organizations on what good looks like for data mesh and being able to track progress towards that, and, you know, the intersection of the team architecture or topology with the technical architecture of the data mesh.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you so much for your time today, Dave, and thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
I'd again like to thank my guest today, Dave Coles, who's the Director of Data and AI at ThoughtWorks Australia. If you'd like to get in touch with Dave to follow up on anything we discussed, you can find his contact information in the show notes as per usual. Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for listening to another great guest on the Data Mesh Learning Podcast. Thanks again to our sponsors, especially DataStax, who actually pays for me full time to help out the Data Mesh community. If you're looking for a scalable, extremely cost-efficient, multi-data center, multi-cloud database offering and or an easy-to-scale data streaming offering, check DataStax out. There's a link in the show notes. If you want to get in touch with me, there's links in the show notes to go ahead and reach out. I would love to hear more about what you're doing with Data Mesh and how I can be helpful. So please do reach out and let me know, as well as if you'd like to be a guest. Check out the show notes for more information. Thanks so much.